With major flooding events in 1993 and 2008 and a number of significant flooding events in between, we need to ask hard questions about how we have altered our environment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last week, the rain fell hard and fields and basements flooded, as they so often do. This hour, we'll talk about agricultural and urban flooding. We'll talk about the changes we've made to our landscape that make it more flood-prone. And we'll talk about the damage flooding can do and some innovative ways farmers, homeowners, and city planners can prevent flooding or at least minimize the damage it can cause. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Last week, in many parts of Iowa where it wasn't snowing, it rained a lot, and a lot of basements flooded. Streams and rivers started spilling over their banks. A lot of people in Iowa thought, here we go again, because, of course, we are no strangers to flooding in this state. This hour, we're going to talk about flooding in Iowa, how we've altered our landscape to make it more flood-prone, and how we can alter it yet again to minimize the damage that flooding can cause. We'll talk about urban flooding, steps homeowners, contractors, city planners, policymakers can take. But we're going to start the hour in the fields. Mark Rasmussen is here. He is the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University. Hello, Mark. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, good.
Okay.
I can hear you.
We're on now.
That's terrific. Mark, let's start in the fields with how, as farmers came to Iowa and altered the land so they could grow all of these amazing crops here, of course, there were problems. There were muddy areas. There were wetlands where they couldn't plant their crops. How did farmers alter these fields to make them what they wanted them to be?
Yes, as you mentioned, it started a very long time ago, several generations ago, when Iowa was first settled for agriculture. And before that time, it was primarily a prairie grass, prairie land state, and prairie, which had evolved over thousands of years, was very efficient at capturing the water and holding the soil and building the soil. And especially in the Des Moines Lobe area, where there was a lot of internal drainage, there was a lot of wetlands and prairie potholes. So when settlers came to the region and started to plow the area and raise crops that they were familiar with, that started to change the hydrology of the landscape, because tilled land holds water differently than does grassed perennial plants that are growing on the land. And so over the years, they obviously started on the uplands, which were drier lands, but around the turn of the century, that is in the early 1900s, laws were passed in Iowa to establish drainage districts, and there had been some drainage efforts before then, but it had primarily been a pretty slow effort with tile spades and handwork. And I'm always amazed when I look back at that kind of history of the amount of work it must have taken to put in tile to do a field. But around the turn of the century, large excavating machines became available to do the work faster and put in the mainline tiles. And so a much greater area was tiled at that time. And those years, right around World War I, were also a intensive agricultural time in terms of markets. And so there was a lot of market pressure to produce a lot of grain. The prices were good. Agriculture had a good time at that time, up until prices crashed right after World War I. But so anyway, and then to carry it forward, we've gone through several of these market cycles, and we're currently in another one right now, in where we are tilling a lot of land. We're bringing land back into production. And So, as I said, all of this kind of effort impacts the hydrology of the landscape.
Well, and I remember back before the farm crisis of the 1980s, again, we were in one of those markets where there was a lot of pressure to put as much land into production as possible. And at that point in time, it wasn't just tiling that was being done, but actually altering the flow of streams. What were farmers doing then to maximize their production land?
Well, it's always easier to plant along a smooth edge than it is a meandering, crooked stream flow. So there's a fundamental tension in water management between agriculture, who in many cases wants to remove excess water and remove it on a pretty rapid basis, especially when you've got saturated soil and you've got plants growing.
You don't want the water sitting there.
Yeah, maybe 48 hours to get that water away so it doesn't drown the plant. But there's the tension with downstream areas where too much water too fast causes problems.
So we really altered our landscapes in many ways to shed water, to push it into these streams and to get it away from where we didn't want it, right?
Yes, in Iowa. And being from Nebraska, this is a new concept to me, because for the most part in Nebraska, we have always been water short. So we don't think of water in the same way that Iowa does.
We've talked about these boom and bust cycles, and the bust cycles seem to be in many ways very good for the environment. This is a time when a lot of farmers are putting land into the Conservation Reserve Program and trying to take advantage of government subsidies to do that. Then we get into a boom cycle and a lot of land leaves CRP.
Yes, and that's currently happening now. I mean, we've got a lot of CRP land that has been brought back out into production. In driving around the state these past few months, I've seen a lot of piles of trees sitting around, too, where little small acres, little odd corners and fields have that used to be in trees or something have been pulled out so that that land can be brought into production, too.
So when you see that, what goes through your mind? What are you thinking about when you see farming right up to the edge of a stream and pulling out of trees and putting land that is marginal back into production?
Well, I understand the motivations, I understand the reasons for doing it, but I also think in terms of longer historical trends that this won't, you know, this is not forever, that we'll go through another cycle, and as you said, then there will be some kind of program or some kind of efforts to put some of this more fragile land back into permanent grass or perennial crops or even trees in some cases.
Let's talk a little bit about soil erosion, because when you see an event like last week and the fields near streams flood, and anything that has a little bit of slope on it has a new stream running down the middle of it, you see a lot of erosion. And even with tilling practices that have changed dramatically over the years, we still see a lot of soil washing away.
Yeah, and that's my biggest concern over the long term, is that soil, when it moves, it's moving the topsoil. It's moving the most important part of the soil profile. And I come from eastern Nebraska, where we didn't have a lot of topsoil. So I think in many ways we appreciated it, what we had, because we didn't have the good, deep, black earth that many parts of Iowa does. And, you know, it seems to be in our American culture that we take some things for granted. But certainly a lot of this new land that we're bringing back into production is some of the more fragile land that is much more prone to erosion. And that is not sustainable in the long run. I mean, we can farm that land in the short run, but, you know, we're going to have to make adjustments over time.
It's easy to take it for granted, though, especially with all of the ways that we can amend the soil with fertilizers. We can make that land fertile. What is your message to farmers who are using a lot of anhydrous ammonia and other tools to make sure that they can grow on a field where the topsoil is getting depleted?
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand the market pressures, and I understand the pressing need for corn and soy right now, which is what the markets are telling farmers to do. But I come from a farming background where we raised a lot of cattle, so our farming was much more diverse. We had hay land, we had pasture land. It wasn't as intensively farmed. It was much more fragile land, so it simply made sense to us to do it that way. And I'd sure encourage farmers to set aside land. I know it's a difficult thing to do in this go-go market to do things like riparian buffers along streams or prairie strips. But there are other things that they can do and still do real crop production too. There's a big emphasis on cover crops right now to help protect that soil during the off season.
When you talk to people about soil erosion, what is your message? Because as I mentioned, it is easy to take it for granted right now.
Well, soil erosion is one of these slow processes that it's easy to ignore, especially real erosion. It's easy to go out there with a disc and just cover it up and not think about it. But I have some interesting pictures that I'm going to be showing some students here later today about, demonstration of how it accumulates over time, buried fence posts in the corner of a field where, 3 feet of soil has basically been moved down and covered up this fence. And you get a more undulating landscape because, as you said, you get these gullies formed and once the water concentrates, then you have problems. I mean, slowing it down and keeping it dispersed are the best strategies that we can think about in terms of water management on a farm with respect to soil erosion. And I think that probably also applies to flooding, too.
Well, we will talk a lot more about solutions as the hour goes on. We'll also talk to a farmer who has put a significant portion of his land into the Conservation Reserve Program and created buffer strips along the streams along his land. And we're also going to talk about urban and suburban flooding as well, some of the steps that we can take to minimize the damage that flooding is doing. We're going to talk about policy changes, and we're going to talk about changes that individuals can make as well. I'm talking with Mark Rasmussen. He's the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. Coming up in just a moment, Larry Weber is going to join our conversation. He's the director of the Iowa Institute of Hydraulic Research and also co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center. And State Senator Rob Hogue will be here. He represents District 19, including Cedar Rapids, in the Iowa Senate. And we want to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about flooding in Iowa, rural flooding, urban flooding, suburban flooding, and how we've changed our landscape over the years to create an environment that is flood-prone. With me is Mark Rasmussen. He's the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. And joining us now is Larry Weber. He's the director of the Iowa Institute of Hydraulic Research, and he's also co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center. And Larry, the rural environment is very important to all of us in Iowa, even if we don't think about it and we don't understand it. But, of course, a lot of us live in towns and large towns, small towns, and a lot of us have seen flooding in those communities over the years. I think particularly about 1993 and 2008. And when we talked about those flooding events, we talked about how incredibly rare they were, especially in 1993, how that was a 100-year flood and we'd never seen anything like it. And then a few years after that, we saw something close. And then in 2008, we saw yet another one of those major flooding events. Why is this happening in Iowa so frequently now?
Well, I think one of the things that we're starting to understand better is that these major events are not floods of a lifetime. And I think in 1993, many people thought that once they had cleaned up after the flood of 93, they would never experience such a flood again. The reality is that even that rare event, the 100-year flood or the 1% recurrence interval flow, has a 1% likelihood each and every year. So every year we face the same likelihood of those flows. So that wasn't very well understood by the public. That's a little better understood today. So we understand that, you know, we're seeing these events more often statistically. The other point is that we've changed the land and we're seeing changes in our rainfall patterns. We see greater events, more intense rainfall over different periods of the year. We're seeing these earlier intense rainfalls. We're seeing later intense rainfalls in the fall, and where we might not have the cover on the lands that we do in the middle of the summer.
Well, let's talk about some of the changes that we've made to our environment, because a lot of us, I think, have the tendency to blame all of this flooding on Mother Nature and changes to rainfall patterns. But that's not the only thing that has changed. So as our cities have grown, what are some of the things that have contributed to more flooding?
Well, and we don't really think – we try not to separate the rural from the urban areas, because we think in terms of a watershed. So everything to us is related to a stream network. But certainly within the urban areas, we have more and more impervious lands. We continue to develop, of course. In periods when streams are within their banks, folks want to move closer and closer to the edge of the bank and the streams. They enjoy the natural beauty of having streams and rivers flowing through their properties or their developments. So we want to try to continue to move our developments closer to the streams. But yet we have these major events where the rivers, you know, come out of bank and then cause the devastation that we see. We've tried to protect those areas. I think we've been have only seen limited success in engineering structures to protect development. And I think one of the misconceptions in building levees and flood walls is that they're flood elimination projects, which they're not. Each levee that gets built or flood wall that gets built has a certain design elevation above which water will flow over the top. And a perfect example is Cedar Rapids in that case, where for many, many years we had the river rise to within a foot or 2 feet of overtopping the levees in Cedar Rapids. And every time that it rose to that elevation and came back down, people felt that, you know, it was doing exactly what it was supposed to, and it eliminated yet another flood. The reality was in 2008 that we overtopped that levee by about 9 or 9.5 feet, and we saw the devastation that that flood caused.
As our cities grow, as we have more parking lots poured and the land surrounding towns becomes more and more covered with concrete, how does that contribute to the rise of our rivers?
Well, we're rising fast. You know, the rivers and streams are flashier. There's no question about that. Any scientific look at historical data, we talk about a flashiness index, which looks at the rate of rise and the rate of fall. And we're seeing an increase in the flashiness of our streams. Water's coming off more quickly. Streams rise faster. The water moves through the system faster, and it comes and then it drops more quickly after the event. So all this impervious area that we're putting out there is moving water overland rather than, you know, through a porous media, the soil surface, and becoming part of the groundwater. And so it moves much more quickly to our streams. And once it's in the stream, as was mentioned earlier, we have a concentrated flow, quickly moving flow, lots of scour, lots of bank erosion, and lots of flooding.
It's not just cement, though, that is impervious to water. I mean, when we build our suburbs and we put in more houses and we put in more lawns, the kinds of lawns that we built are not particularly absorbent either, are they?
No, that's right, because the turf grass that's, you know, most commonly seen is a type of land surface that does not allow the same infiltration of water into our near-surface groundwaters. So even the turf lawns themselves, they're not as bad as the pavement, but they're certainly not as porous as those native prairies that we had here historically. So I think we're seeing more responsible development where cities are starting to develop guidelines or ordinances in some case where they're looking at zero runoff conditions where we're not increasing or at least no increase in runoff as they do their development. So trying to develop, you know, strategies there to make those developers more responsible. Again, I think sometimes there's this pressure of, you know, trying for economic development, trying to meet the demand of increased needs for housing. Developers come in. They have a very particular motive. And of course, that's
to give the customer what they want.
Give the customer what they want, develop the land and move on. And then the cities are left, you know, bearing all the risk. And so we've privatized the sort of the reward. We socialize the risk.
Well, as I mentioned, I want to focus more on solutions here in a couple of minutes and on the research that you have done at the Iowa Flood Center and research that you are doing with the Iowa Watersheds Project in just a moment. I want to bring Senator Rob Hogue into the conversation now as well. He represents District 19, including Cedar Rapids, in the Iowa Senate. Hello, Senator Hogue.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Happy to be here.
And I want to talk about the conversation and how it's evolved about flooding, because when I think back to 1993 and those major flooding events all over Iowa, it strikes me that back then the conversation was a lot about how do we protect houses from getting flooded. As time has marched forward, and as we were just talking about with Larry Weber, we've seen levees overtopped and flood walls overtopped. How, from your perspective, has the conversation changed?
Well, I think, Charity, you know, I wasn't in the legislature in '93, and I know at the time there were recommendations made to take positive action towards preventing future flood damage, and those weren't necessarily acted on at the time. Since the 2008 flood, I think policymakers have tried to be more proactive. We've done a number of things, including the creation of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa to update our maps and make them accessible over the internet statewide, reinvesting in the Department of Natural Resources floodplain management program, adding stream gauges around the state, and that's had support. Last year, we also passed legislation to establish a flood mitigation board, which is going to help cities and counties on larger infrastructure projects that are related to reducing flood risk. That board meets for the first time next Tuesday, so that's good. I think people recognize there's more need for proactive efforts on our part. Director Weber talked about the increase in rain events. And the increasing intensity of those rain events. You know, I don't remember as a kid growing up in Iowa, North Liberty and cities like that getting 8 inches of rain. A couple years ago, Dubuque had over 12 inches of rain in July of 2011. So I personally believe the climate's changing, and that doesn't mean that it changes everything necessarily. It just means the effort to be proactive is more urgent than even it was before. You know, Charity, the dollars and cents on this, Iowa has suffered over $20 billion in flood damage in the last 20 years. And, you know, we can continue to pay for flood damage or we can be proactive to reduce flood risk. And that's where I've been focused on, and I think we're making some progress on it, although we have a long way to go.
And that's a hard case to make for many people, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, you know, I even watch, like in Cedar Rapids, which, of course, wasn't the only city flooded in 2008, but had the largest dollar damage in 2008. You know, we're 5 years later. People are feeling a little bit, you know, maybe they're starting to have that memory fade. And what I've been telling people is we really need to maintain vigilance about reducing flood risk because it's a lot cheaper, it's a lot better to avoid the heartache and trauma that goes with flooding if we can be proactive and prevent that damage in the first place.
Well, I want to talk about the Iowa Watersheds Project, and I know that, Senator Hogue, you were instrumental in getting that project funded and passed.
Well, I helped on it. I don't know if instrumental is the way to talk about it, but I know Larry has been doing a good job running that program. And that was one of the things that was done with federal money, and it was really important to do to be proactive. So, for example, we have been in Linn County. There's a watershed management authority on Indian Creek. There's a seven county upper Cedar River Watershed Management Authority, and those are the ones in the Cedar Basin that I know of, but I know there are other watershed projects around the state on a targeted basis trying to reduce flood risk and also, while we're at it, improve water quality, because those are two things that we can do simultaneously.
Larry, I want to bring you back into the conversation. As you're researching watersheds, are there things that we don't understand about how watersheds function with and interact with all of the development and agriculture that we have?
Well, I think we understand conceptually how things interact and function. The challenge that we've faced in the past is that we haven't been able to quantify that. So if a question comes to the legislature and says, well, exactly what type of funding would it take to reduce the flood damages in Cedar Rapids by doing distributed projects, it's hard to quantify that today. The Iowa Watersheds Project is an attempt at answering that question and really providing guidance to us over the next several generations. One example of that project and some results that we're seeing is we're modeling in a small watershed in southern Iowa called Soap Creek. And Soap Creek is a very unique watershed because landowners came together back in the mid-80s and said, we have changed the hydrologic response of our streams based on our farming practices. They wrote a plan. The plan indicated they should build 152 distributed projects in the watershed. As of 2012, they've completed 132 of them. But nobody's come back and assessed what the benefit has been. So we're applying our mathematical models to the watershed with these projects installed. And we're seeing from the upper part of the watershed a stream flow reduction of 70% for the 100-year precipitation. And at the outlet of the watershed, a reduction of 40% of the stream flow during the 100-year precipitation. That's significant. And the total cost of their project was about $8 to $9 million. We have that sort of cost information. We're developing this technical modeling information, and we're applying that to the Upper Cedar, to Turkey, the Turkey River watershed, and the Middle Raccoon. So now we're doing this in other areas and other landforms in Iowa, and we think that within the next couple years we'll be able to have that good quantitative information for policy and decision makers to act upon.
Now, of course, a lot of land in a watershed is privately owned and farmed by individuals. How do you make the case to a farmer that this is worth their time and effort to create a buffer along a stream?
That's been one of the most rewarding parts of this project. As we've gone out and worked with landowners, this is an entirely voluntary project. We do have federal funds to build additional projects. We'll be building about $4.5 million of additional projects in the three watersheds that I've mentioned. And farmers are coming to us and saying they want to be part of this. And in Soap Creek, I think they started slow. The first few projects, it took landowners stepping out of their comfort zone to say they wanted to be part of building a wetland, building a farm pond, taking down an agricultural levee to allow a floodplain to function. But once they've done that, their neighbors have seen the benefit that that individual has had by having a wonderful project, a fishable, swimmable, wadable project on their lands, and then the benefit that it's served the neighbors that are downstream and downstream from that.
And Mark Rasmussen, you've been involved in building a buffer project along Bear Creek in central Iowa, right?
Yeah. Iowa State and the Leopold Center have had a long-standing arrangement in working on that, and it has gained national notoriety as a effective demonstration project.
Can you describe what you've done?
Well, basically, it was a stream that had been farmed up to the edge, and the landowners were willing to take a chance and allow things to happen so that a 60 or 80 foot strip along the stream was planted with bushes and grass and trees, and then a whole lot of measurements were taken in terms of water quality and runoff, and it's demonstrated real benefits.
And Bear Creek empties into the Des Moines River, right?
The Skunk.
Oh, the skunk. Okay, sorry. Close. So as you've seen the changes along Bear Creek, and Larry, maybe you can jump in here with talking about Soap Creek. How much of an impact can something like that have on perhaps a flooding event? Larry?
Well, you know, as I mentioned in Soap Creek, a reduction of 40% of the flow, we've seen rainfall events in 2011 where a neighboring watershed, Chiquest Creek, saw Chiquest come well out of bank full and flood the lowlands, whereas Soap Creek in the same rainfall event remained within the banks. So again, once we come out onto the banks, you know, most of these floodplain areas, the water expands out pretty widely. And so holding that water within the bank, you know, that's one example, one 6.5-inch rainfall event that came upon southern Iowa, two watersheds right next to each other. One stayed in the bank, one didn't.
We're going to take a short break and we'll get back to our conversation about flooding in Iowa, how our altered environment creates a more flood-prone environment in Iowa. And now we're going to focus on solutions. With me is Larry Weber, the director of the Iowa Institute of Hydraulic Research and co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center, Mark Rasmussen, director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University, and State Senator Rob Hoge, who represents District 19, which of course includes flood-prone Cedar Rapids in his district in the Iowa Senate. We'd also like to hear from you at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about flooding in Iowa, and in this segment of the show, we're going to focus on solutions that farmers can participate in, solutions that city planners can participate in, that politicians can participate in, and we want to hear from you as well at 866-780-9100. With me is Larry Weber, director of the Iowa Institute of Hydraulic Research and co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center. State Senator Rob Hoge is here. He represents District 19 in the Iowa Senate. Mark Rasmussen, director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, is also here. And I want to turn now to John Berto, who is a farmer in Washington County. Hello, John.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. And you own a 1,200-acre farm in Washington County?
Yes, we do. I farm with my two sons, and we're the seventh generation farmers in the county.
And I understand that you have taken quite a few steps toward conservation on your farm. Can you give me an idea of some of the things that you've done?
Well, we've built terraces. We started building terraces 30 years ago, I'm supposing, and we've put in buffer strips along the creeks to help erosion. And in the last 5 years, we've started a big tiling project to try and keep the soil dry. And turning strips at the end of the field when we pull the planter out of the field and make a turn, rather than let it wash down the row, we seed that down.
Why has it been important to you to make some of these changes? And in particular, let's talk about the buffer strips along the creeks, because for a lot of farmers, that takes land out of production, and it's a hard case to make for farmers to do that. What made you want to do that?
Well, the big thing it wants me to do it is that we're seventh. I'm the fifth, and my sons are the sixth, and my grandchildren are the seventh, and the big reason is I want my grandchildren to still farm that farm, take a lot of pride in that. And I'm not doing it for me, and I'm doing it for generations after me. I want the land to be there. I want it to be fertile, and I want to take care of it.
In putting in those buffer strips, what kind of changes have you seen on your land because of your changes?
I think when the creek floods, it slows the water down, and any time you can slow water down, that's a big help. And we put these in, it slows the water down, and then when the water leaves, hopefully it filters some of the dirt out and leaves the fertile ground on our farm. And over a period of, it's nothing quick. But over a period of 30, 40 years, hopefully it'll improve the soil and improve the dirt. It'll keep the dirt out of the creek, keep it where it needs to be.
What kind of a financial investment have you had to make to put in these buffer strips?
It's not real costly, except it just takes land out of production, and I still have to pay taxes on the land, and some of it we've been able to get into the, they don't call it the CRP, but I do. It's a buffer strip. Some of it we've got in that, and the government helps some, but basically it's a kind of a donation that my sons and I make, and to protect the ground for my grandkids.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Mm-hmm.
John Berto is a farmer in Washington County. He owns a 1,200-acre farm that he runs with his two sons. And Mark, talking to John, he's clearly somebody who is looking at his land and the health of his land long term. There are many farmers in Iowa. I mean, farm prices, land prices are so high, a lot of farmers can't own their own land, and they rent land, and this isn't land that's going to be in their family for generations. Is it hard to make the case for these kind of conservation practices with people who don't have a long-term investment in their land?
Yeah, that's a more difficult case. At the Leopold Center and other organizations, we are trying to connect, though, with landowners that may be absentee landowners. Because when a farmer leases land and it may only be for a year or two in terms of the lease, there's not as much incentive to do that sort of thing as John described, where he's looking out one or two generations into the future. So, trying to work with absentee landowners is an important part of the process, too.
Well, I live in the country, and I am not much of a landowner, but I observe the farmers around me, and the land adjacent to mine is farmed by someone who rents the land. He also rents land from a neighbor of mine, and in the two different fields, he's using very, very different practices, because my neighbor wants buffer strips, and the absentee landowner he rents from near my home doesn't seem to put in any control. So this is really a question of what the landowners need to require from their renters, you think?
That's certainly part of it. I mean, it's a negotiation process between the landowner and the farmer as to how a farm will be farmed.
I want to go back to the phones. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Well, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, as farmers and landowners, and I am a landowner and part-time farmer, we do have to understand we are here for a certain amount of time, and then the land goes to somebody else. We should not have the right to destroy the land as it affects others now and also in the future. If one drives across the state, it is obvious the misuse of the land is rampant, as you have mentioned, Mark and Larry. If we wait for voluntary conservation of our resources, it won't happen on a significant scale. Mother Nature certainly has the laws of biology, physics, and chemistry on her side, and Mother Nature bats 1,000%. And if we aren't going to like many of the answers she has for us, and if we don't start serious conservation now, we're going to have problems down the road. And she's already given us a number of catastrophic events, and we're figuring out what to do about it. It's just a matter of the political will to do something about it really seriously. And I'd like Larry, Senator Hoag, and Mark to give your thoughts on that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Bill. And Larry, would you like to respond first?
Well, I would. It's one of the things that I've been sharing around the state is that we need to bring balance. Right now we're out of balance, and the balance needs to be between agricultural, economic, natural, and water resources. And if we take any one of those and we get it too far out of balance, then we're going to get into an unsustainable system. And right now, I think the agriculture and economic resources are a bit out of balance with our natural and water resources. And so we have to understand that we need to invest in all areas for a long-term sustainable Iowa. I'm an Iowan. I grew up in Iowa. I grew up on a family farm. All of my family are farmers, and we've got to have that balance.
Senator Hoag, give us some insight into the political conversation in Des Moines, because any legislation that changes how farmers practice seems to be highly controversial.
Well, I think there is a reluctance, Charity, at the state level, especially right now, to mandate changes. I really appreciate Bill and John and their comments. You know, I guess my message would be we're really in this together, right? This is all of us together. And I've had to remind people in Cedar Rapids, the flood of 2008 just wasn't Cedar Rapids. It was flooding in many dozens of communities across our state. And then in 2010, it was Ames, Ottumwa, Colfax, Cherokee, Four Mile Creek neighborhood in Des Moines, Lake Delhi. 2011, it was Western Iowa and Dubuque and Northeast Iowa. And what I've been trying to convey is that we really need to come at this with some urgency. I tell people we need a spirit of the sandbag, just like all those volunteers poured out to safeguard Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids on the night of June 12th and our final water intake facility. We need people to step up. And so there are dozens of things individuals can do in urban areas and on the farm. What we need, though, is state policy to elevate this. This is not a matter of we're going to spend a couple dimes per acre and fix the problem. We can do a lot of things on a voluntary basis, but it's going to take a targeted investment of dollars and have the state and have the public be a partner in helping landowners do the right thing that in most cases, and I think we heard from Bill and John, they want to do that. So let's pull together. Let's take the action we need to prevent future flood damage. We can't prevent every future flood, but we can reduce flood damage in future flood events, and it's urgent that we do that because I'm just telling you, we don't want Iowans suffering the heartache and trauma that they suffer when their homes flood and they lose their possessions, they might lose their home. It is truly, truly awful thing for people to experience.
I can imagine some farmers listening to this kind of conversation and thinking, you know, they want us to make all the changes and it's going to cost us money. And why on earth is this entirely on the backs of farmers? So, Senator Hogue, when I hear you talking, I hear you saying that we need to invest enough money to make this not a burden to farmers.
Well, that's part of it. I also said, Charity, that this is something that urban people have to do, too. There are a lot of things people in an urban setting can do, pervious pavements, rainwater harvesting, rain gardens, wetland restoration. We have our job to do. Farmers have their jobs to do. And in both cases, we need to have financial assistance to make that happen because the benefit is for the public. We suffered $5 billion of economic damage in Cedar Rapids alone. That is an extraordinary amount of money, over $40,000 per resident in the city of Cedar Rapids in terms of damage. And obviously that hurt, you know, when we have Cargill closed because of flooding, well, that hurts farmers. And so we really are in this together, but we're not going to nickel and dime this problem. We have to be willing to invest the resources, and if we do that, we will actually save money in the long run. Hazard mitigation investments that we've made in the state, according to our Homeland Security Agency, have already saved more than $2 for every dollar we invested, and those mitigation measures are in place for future disasters. So this is something where I think people need to come together and say, let's invest more to make sure we deal with this problem, and in the long run, it's going to save us a lot of money, and more importantly, from my perspective, avoid the heartache and trauma that goes with flood damage.
Daryl's on the line from Elkader. Hi, Daryl.
Hi.
Hi. Quickly, what would you like to talk about?
Very quickly, just from listening here now, financial incentives to farmers to do these things is fantastic, but farmers can help themselves. Also, I'm a 100% no-till farmer, and the economic advantages just for that to myself have been fantastic, and it helps the ground. The ground can take in the water faster. It doesn't run off. Being in the Turkey River watershed, it's very important to me to try to keep our rivers clean. And just doing these simple things, farmers, yeah, you can pay them to do things, but if they keep farming the rest of the land with tillage, and it's not going to do it. But it does you pay yourself. I guess I want to get that across to farmers out there. You do pay yourself by doing no-till.
Daryl, thank you so much for your call. And this is an email that we have from Cindy. One reason conservation is a hard sell for farmers is that water pollution by row crop agriculture is completely legal and unregulated now. Wouldn't it help flooding, water quality, and soil conservation if agriculture were required to protect water quality via regulations like other industries are required to do already? And there is legislation pending that actually addresses that. Larry?
Well, I can't really speak to that. I mean, perhaps Senator Ho could speak to that more. I think there's a number of things that are going on in the state, whether it's related to nutrient management from non-point sources, again, we're going to take a voluntary approach in Iowa. We've got to work together on that. We've got to bring better science to it. We need some good and thoughtful policy decisions as well.
And Senator Ho?
Well, a couple things. I mean, first of all, any day the EPA could come in and say, we're taking over the state's clean water program. They have done that in other areas. The Clean Water Act provides a regulatory framework for total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, total maximum daily loads, for river bodies. And using that, they can go on and the EPA could come in and mandate things. And we are in danger of having that happen unless we really improve a voluntary approach. I would prefer a voluntary approach to work if we can make it work. I think that's much better for our farmers. Not every farm is the same. Director Weber makes a great point there about the sound science and making sure what we're doing is working. That's something I strongly support. But what Charity, here's the kind of the point, and I really appreciate Daryl's call. It's doing nothing isn't going to work. We have got to make significant investments and significant changes if we want to reduce future flood damage and improve water quality. And, you know, unfortunately, the status quo wins if we don't do something. And there's inertia. So we've got to fight back against that, say, you know what, we're all in this together. The state's in a good financial position right now. We understand nobody wants to go the regulatory route if we can avoid it. So let's put the dollars in right now. To give the voluntary approach a chance to work. Let's make sure we have the sound science that goes with it. And I think we can do these things and really make a difference. But if we try to nickel and dime the problem, we will just be back 5 years from now, same discussion, more flood damage, worse water quality. And at some point, EPA is going to say, you know what, we've got to step in. And that's something we all want to avoid.
Senator Hoag, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
State Senator Rob Hoag represents District 19 in the Iowa Senate. And Mark Rasmussen, when you look to the future, clearly at the Leopold Center, you're working to spread a message. But what do you think it's going to take to make real significant changes in Iowa that will prevent a lot of the flooding damage we've experienced in the past?
Well, actually, I'm fairly encouraged because having been away from Iowa for a few years and coming back, you know, I see as I drive down the road, I see a lot of land where there are buffers and headlands, as one caller mentioned, putting in headlands for turning. And so progress is being made. It may not be as fast as we'd like it. One thing I was thinking about from the senator's comments was that with all of the billions of dollars in damage, you know, that's kind of a reactive approach that we had to take with flooding. But what if we'd have spent that kind of money upstream in order to prevent the problem? You know, I think that's where we need to think, is upstream.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Rasmussen is director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. And Larry Weber, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Larry Weber is director of the Iowa Institute of Hydraulic Research and co-founder of the Iowa Flood Center. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day, and we're going to talk about weed control. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.